BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Just a word of warning. This podcast includes strong language, use of racist terms, and descriptions of violence. Be warned.
This morning, the people of Brixton in South London are counting the cost of a weekend of violence in which nearly 200 people were injured and property damaged to the tune of millions of pounds. Of those hurt, 150 were policemen. One of them is still unconscious with a fractured skull.
For a whole weekend in April 1981, Brixton was going out of control, blood.
We reversed the whole dynamics against them. They were brutalising us for decades with abuse of power.
Molotov cocktails, burning buildings, looting. London had never seen anything like this before.
I've seen a score of policemen dragged back out of the smoke, blood pouring down their faces, their legs trailing along the streets which are carpeted with shattered glass. In the centre of Brixton, 200 yards away from the worst of the rioting, the shops are being freely, almost casually looted. Discarded tailors' dummies lie macabrely in the road.
I'm Big Nasty, and from BBC Sounds and BBC Radio 5 Live, this is Brixton, Flames on the Frontline.
We simply didn't know what was going on, apart from the fact that all of Brixton High Street appeared to be wrecked. Routon Road appeared just to be littered with burnt out cars, burnt out buildings. A lot of police officers were getting injured, and we felt it was probably only a matter of time until people start getting killed.
This is a story of how and why riots erupted in Brixton and why it still matters today.
It was utter devastation, seeing fires going, and we could see the damage that was done to the shops, you know, the mannequins that were strewn all over the street. And we were thinking, is this going to be our legacy now?
In this episode, the face-off between the police and the people is getting serious, and both sides bring new tactics to the front line. Episode 2, Fuel to the Fire.
I was born in Seaforth, Jamaica in the 1950s, and I left in 1956. We were taken to London. So I arrived in London in November 1956. It was dark, grey and cold.
Say hello to Winston True. We're going to be spending some time with him. Winston came to the UK as part of the Windrush generation. Life in Britain did not get off to a good start, though.
I was welcomed to England with a punch in the face. My first day at school, I was 6 years and 4 months old. I was taken to school by my mother, left in the playground. I was the only black boy in the school. I was sitting on a wall, and a white boy walked up to me and punched me in my face and walked off. I was so shocked, I didn't know what to do. A white girl held my hand and took me into the school. I went to register as I was new, and then that was it. My welcome to England, my first day in England, was to be punched in the face by white people. And I think that more or less set the tone for the rest of my life in this country.
By the early 70s, Winston had settled down and started a family. But life was tough. With no job, he was living with the in-laws. 8 of them in one yard. Not much cash coming in. So what was he like back then?
Right, the picture, a portrait of Winston True in 1972. I'd left my mother's home. Moved in with my girlfriend, who lived with her father and two brothers and sisters in Peckham. At that time, as a young man, I was very interested in records, black music.
That is a serious understatement. He loved music.
One song that spoke to us was Young, Gifted and Black by Bob and Marcia Griffiths. There's James Brown, Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud, from 1960s. Put your bad self, say it loud. There's Syl Johnson's Is It Because I'm Black from 1971.
This guy had an encyclopedia of tunes in his head.
The dark brown shades of my skin.
There's one tune by Prince Buster called Black Man Must Be Free.
Black man must be free to be what he wants to be.
That record was banned in Jamaica. You might be able to buy it now. So a lot of the tunes we listen to were what called underground music.
To keep me down in slavery.
Sick playlist, blood. Notice this though, all tracks have a familiar theme. Respect yourself, be proud of being black, and stand up for who you are. Music was serious for Winston. It could take him to a good place, but he needed something more. Say it loud, I'm black and I'm proud. Winston didn't just want to hear that, he wanted to live it. And that was about to happen when he discovered a movement called Black Power. Its aim to transform the lives of black people in Britain. It all started for Winston when his brother came calling.
It was one Saturday, my brother came to me and said, Wince. So I was at home on Saturday, living in Peckham, my two children, sitting in the back room playing, talking. I think I might have been playing some records. Brother came and said, look, he's been to a Black Power organisation in New Cross, so I should come along. That was Saturday. I should come the next day, the Sunday. I said, okay.
I would have been pumped to see him walk through the door.
Went along on a Sunday afternoon, and I was overwhelmed. For the first time in my life, I walked into the basement, and I saw a sea of black faces, all young men and women like myself. It was lovely. People say, hello, brother. How you doing, brother? Welcome. For the first time in my life, I found myself amongst black, young black people who had a positive, conscious view of the world and of themselves. And men there with an Afro hairdo, black power badges. Women there with their hair in Afro, in Kanaro, wearing dashiki shirts. It was absolutely wonderful.
Before Winston gets ahead of himself, let's pause for a sec, because there's more you should know. When Winston was growing up, his dad worked in the underground and was killed in a freak accident. His mum couldn't manage with six children and Winston ended up in care for a time. That's just the half of it. He's had it tough, blood. So put yourself in his shoes for a minute. This is a guy who feels like he's been on the back foot since the day he arrived in London, until he walked into that meeting. Suddenly, yeah, he was surrounded by other young, motivated, energetic people who, like him, were keen to redefine their identity as black people.
The low ceiling made the place feel warm, you were comfortable, you relaxed. A speaker spoke about the reason why we were all gathered there, spoke about our history of slavery, our history of colonization. Our parents come to this country given low-rated jobs, discrimination in school. He spoke about things that we could all understand and tune into. It was great. I left the meeting that Sunday afternoon, went home, sat down there in my house, stared into the wall, and I said to myself, I've actually found a place where I could be, where I could belong to. A group of young people, we're all young, gifted, and black. And one of the songs playing on the radio was the Bobby Marcy's version of the Nina Simone tune called Young, Gifted, and Black. And that was it. I never looked back since.
Winston joined a black power group called the Fasimbas. Soon he was everywhere, out on the streets, campaigning, holding meetings, reading, learning, even taking karate lessons so he could mash up a man who tried to violate. Winston was a changed man.
It was a wonderful part of my life, a wonderful time in my life, where I saw lots of good things on the horizon for me. So that was me as a black young man.
In London alone, I think there are probably six or seven different black organisations, black power movements, all with differing degrees of ideology.
Leela Hassan Howe was right on it too. She would become a leading light in the black power movement and wanted to change the face of Britain.
We felt pretty powerful because there were many of us. I joined an organisation which had a branch in North London, was one in Manchester, so it wasn't just London based. But certainly our inspiration, without a doubt, came from the radical movements in the United States. What we do know about the Black Panther Party, the major difference for us was the fact that they carried guns, and in the United Kingdom, of course, we didn't have guns.
If you mentioned Black Power back in the late 60s or early 70s, the Black Panther Party in the US would have sprung in their mind. People said they were notorious, angry and aggressive. They were explicit in what they were about and no one was going to stand in their way.
So the concept is this, basically. The whole black nation has to be put together as a black army. And we're going to walk on this nation. We're going to walk on this racist power structure. And we're going to say to the whole damn government, stick them up, motherfucker. This is a hold up. We come for what's ours.
Founded in California, this was a civil rights movement which had the same goals as its predecessors, but with a different approach. These guys wore paramilitary gear. They carried guns. They wanted everybody to sit up and take notice. A British version of the Black Panthers soon arrived. It shared some of the Americans' bold ideas, but guns were never part of the picture. In London, Farooq Dondi, who had recently moved to the UK from India, was taking notice of what they were up to.
They adopted the slogan, by any means necessary. And so they were a militant organisation, or at least they made militant noises, were treated as such by the American establishment, who attacked them, killed a few, imprisoned some, tried people. And these radical black groups, you know, carrying guns, wearing berets, having a uniform almost, and recruiting more and more young blacks from all over America, became the inspiration for a worldwide movement in different continents.
In 1970, Farooq joined the UK Panthers, which had a base, you know it, in Brixton. This was Black Power British style. Take my man Farooq. He had thick wavy hair and a bushy beard. He looked more hippie than hard man. And in the 60s, he even hung out with the Beatles. For the British Panthers, the game was all about bold but non-violent protest. It was about education, arming people with knowledge, and challenging injustice wherever they found it. The reputation of the US Black Panthers certainly helped their profile. It made people take notice.
The slogan was, black is a political colour. We demand our rights, we demand to be equal, we demand an end to the legacies of slavery and discrimination and segregation. And it began its program of agitation, propaganda and so on, in the interests of getting justice on all sorts of fronts, housing, employment, wages, education, so on. The rest was anti-police agitation, anti-police actions. It wasn't that we were against the police. It was against what the police were doing to young blacks.
Leela also said something big was happening. The children of the Windrush, the first generation born in the UK, were growing up different from their parents. Britain was the only home they've ever known. They were not going to get pushed around.
The culture that was around at the time just gave us a feeling of strength, and that we were very serious about wanting change in society.
In the Black Panther movement, we weren't part of a mission to complain. We were part of the fight back against whatever complaints or discrimination one felt.
For us in Britain, our Black Power movement was part of that movement for change that was really a worldwide phenomenon at that time.
For Winston too, it was massive. It was transforming his whole world.
It's up to us to educate ourselves, organise ourselves, and to change ourselves in order to change society. And changing society was a long-term goal. It wasn't a five-year programme or a 10-year programme. It's a lifelong programme. It was disciplined, educated, conscious young people.
If Black Power was going to gather strength, it needed a base. Home turf, you get me? It had to be Brixton.
If you walked up the road, you'd have the Black Panther movement going on. So I was very much aware of the changes that needed to take place in our community and the undercurrent that was running alongside it.
Over Carnegie, came to the UK from Jamaica as a child, settled in Brixton with her parents and three siblings. She had plans from the very beginning.
When I was small, when I was about 3 or 4, that's when I started to say that I wanted to be a nurse.
Olga was bright, smart and proud of being black. Her mission was to be a nurse, but I guess Brixton had rubbed off on her too. And at the same time, she totally fell for black power. It was all part of the same thing, keep your faith and follow your dreams. But she also looked to the States for inspiration. Remember those US Black Panthers I told you about? One of them was called Angela Davis. At the time, she was a divisive figure after being caught up in a controversy over guns and violence. But for 15-year-old Olga, all that really mattered was Angela Davis's message to believe in yourself.
Angela Davis was an inspiration to me. She taught me that I shouldn't be ashamed of who I am. I'm black and I'm beautiful, and there's no way that I should conform. You know, she wore a beautiful afro at the time, and for me, that was an inspiration because I could be my natural self and I didn't have to be ashamed or even think that I needed to look a certain way to be accepted in the wider community. There was a time when you'd think that black was a negative thing and she wanted to change that negativity into something positive. And for me, that is just fundamental.
Olga thought her friends needed black power in their lives too. So she started spreading word in the schoolyard. Which is a good thing, right? Wrong.
I was talking to my friends about Black Power Movement and about Angela Davis. She highlighted for us the need for us to be together and to support each other. But my teacher didn't see it that way. She thought I was stirring things and that I was a negative influence on my friends at school. And I was asked to leave school because of that. I was permanently excluded, never to go back.
And that was it. The school holidays were coming, and Olga was told not to come back. Her dreams of nursing were gone in an instant.
I wanted to take exams, and I, at that time I wanted to be a nurse. And I knew that I couldn't go into nursing at the level I wanted to, without some form of qualifications. So I was very upset.
It was a massive setback for Olga, but she wasn't going to be kept down. She'd end up fighting for black rights, working for a community organisation in Brixton. And that's what black power is all about. Standing up when society wants to keep you down. And Brixton needed it the most, especially when the cops were on patrol. That was the front line in the fight of black power. Back in the 70s, there started to be a fear about a new kind of crime wave spreading through the British media. There had always been street crime, but now it had a new name imported from America, mugging. The papers were full of panic that black youth were at it all over London. The police were under pressure to get on top of it, especially in the black areas like Brixton.
We had close contacts with people at our neighbouring police stations. Of course we did. We knew them. We would sometimes, you know, turn up to calls together and even play sport together and socialise together.
Peter Blexley now has a media career appearing in shows about crime. But in the late 1970s, he was a rookie PC based at Peckham Station, up the road from Brixton.
So we knew what was going on in the neighbouring police stations, including Brixton. And Brixton had a robbery squad that had been set up essentially to deal with the fairly recent crime trend of mugging, whereby invariably women were robbed of their handbags, their purses and the like. And this was seen particularly to be a crime committed almost exclusively by young black men. And the Brixton robbery squad had a reputation that preceded them. I discovered that some cops were pretty blasé about gathering evidence. In fact, they would fit people up and they would beat people up. I saw firsthand how police officers would fabricate evidence in order to arrest people that they simply didn't like the look of.
It was pretty easy to arrest people back then, and that's thanks to something called the Sus Law. Sus was like stop and search, but on speed. The police could arrest you if they reckoned you was hanging around intending to commit a crime. They didn't even have to catch you actually doing anything. If they reckoned you was loitering and planning trouble, that was enough.
I served at Brixton for 7 years and I finished my service as Commandant or Chief Officer of the Force. Got involved in various major incidents, including the Brixton riots, where I was a serial commander. A serial was a group of, there was about 30 specials formed into a serial and deployed in Routon Road.
Bernard Willis worked in Brixton Station as a special constable. In an interview with the Museum of London, he says SUS was used to single out certain groups of people, but the aim was to cut crime.
So the SUS law was something that had been around for 120, 130 years. So what you had was the ability, if you saw somebody acting suspiciously, to search them. As a mod, growing up, I had supposedly been acting suspiciously. It was what the Americans called profiling. I was a mod, therefore I must be doing something wrong. I must be carrying drugs, I must be carrying a knife, I must be doing something wrong. The same thing applied to the black community, but it wasn't because they were black. It was being done on the basis of a preconceived view about what certain people did at certain times. And it was applied throughout the Metropolitan Police District. Young police officers were encouraged to do it because it found out crimes that would not otherwise have been found out.
So to use SUS, yeah, all they needed is what they called one or more credible witnesses. So if you've got two cops out on patrol, that's job done, blood. No victims or other evidence needed. And with pressure on the police, yeah, to tackle muggings, Peter Blexley says there were corrupt officers who would target black youths to give the impression they were cleaning up the streets.
So to be arrested and charged under SUS, a police officer would have to give evidence of seeing two overt acts. There were variances of SUS. So, a police officer would say, for example, that he saw a young black man standing at a bus stop. A bus approaches. A woman, invariably wearing a green coat with a handbag over her shoulder, joins the throng of people as they scramble to get on the bus. The same young black man would be seen to approach her handbag, extend his arm, put his hand towards her handbag, and then withdraw it as the same lady tugged it back under her arm. That would be one overt act. The officer would then give evidence that 5 or 10 minutes later, along came another bus, and that kind of scenario was simply reenacted. Of course, there was no CCTV. There was no filming on mobile phones. These people were lambs to the slaughter. They had very little chance of proving their innocence.
Remember our Brixton boys? Sheldon, Christopher and Tony from episode 1. They knew exactly what Peter was talking about. Have a listen to Christopher.
We definitely knew about the SUS laws. That's the thing that we talked about all the time. The SUS law. They can stop you for SUS. You know, just suspicion. We suspect that you're going to do, and that's what they used to say, we suspect that you're going to do a robbery, or there's been a robbery and you fit the description. Because, you know, teenagers often dress the same. They have the same styles, because we're of the same age group. Yeah, definitely we knew about the SUS laws, and we felt the effects of it because we were on the front line of it. The SUS law was for us.
By the time Olga had started working full-time at the Brixton Neighbourhood Community Association, it was something she was seeing on a regular basis, and she was powerless to do anything about it.
Once you got stopped and searched, there was no way you were just going to be let off to go about your business. You would find that the majority of people were taken down to the police station. And some of the stories that came out of Brixton, especially Brixton Police Station, was that once you were arrested or even taken in for questioning, your heads would be flushed down toilets. And the people who were actually being arrested were also calling out their names to say, I'm being arrested and this is where I live. Can you tell my parents or can you tell
whoever it is, just so that someone comes to make sure that I'm okay. It wasn't nice, and it wasn't a rare thing. It was something that was going on almost on a daily basis.
It sounds relentless. It sounds racist. But was it? Former Special Police Constable Bernard Willis says not.
The police were being as harsh on the community as perhaps they had been before, but the community was no longer white, it was black. And it's very easy for people to say, you're picking on me because the black community were getting treated very much like the white community, but weren't prepared to suffer it. Beating people up in the cells was not unknown. The fact that it happened to be a black man that got beaten up this day and a white man that got beaten up the next day was very much a question of how many white men were there committing crime and how many black men were there committing crime. It wasn't necessarily because it was a black man they were dealing with. It was just that they weren't behaving in a correct fashion.
Problem was, if you were a black man in 70s Brixton, you couldn't help feel this was definitely racist blood. All this dragging people off the streets could ruin lives. It was something Winston True was about to discover. In this podcast, we are recreating crazy moments which changed the course of our characters' lives. We've used their own words and created a piece of drama to get you closer to what they've experienced. Let's go back to one night in March 1972, as Winston travelled home on the tube from a Fasimba's meeting. Everything's fine until they come face to face with British Transport Police.
So there was myself, Winston. The other three friends were Chris Sterling and Christy, and the first ones was George Griffiths, we called Bunny. The other person was Constantine, that we called Omar. So it's me, Chris, Bunny and Omar making our way down to Manor House Station. We got onto the train, got out at Oval Station. Nothing to it. A simple ride on the tube. We've all done it, made it dozens of times. We got on the escalator, and as we reached the top, a group of men had suddenly appeared from nowhere. They started shouting and pushing at us. Get over there! Over there, we said. Against the wall. We went, no. What do you want? Why are you pushing at us like that for? We're police, yeah? So? So where's your ID? Never you bloody mind. You lot have been nicking handbags. We're going to search you lot. I said, don't be bloody stupid. We're not nicking any handbag. Anyway, how do we know you're police? Show us your ID. That's when we started pushing them back. Before long, a fright broke out. We didn't believe they were police, honestly. We thought they were a bunch of drunk white boys having a laugh. It was Thursday night. Pubs were closing. I have lost count the number of times I've had rucks with mouthy, drunken white lads who fancy taking on a bunch of black boys.
You're under arrest.
This was no different, I thought. At least at first.
You're under arrest.
So it was all starting to kick off at the top of the escalator. Just in front of the exit now.
Let go.
I remember kicking one of them down and kicking another one. One jumps on my back. I threw him on the floor in spite of the rock. They had plenty of time to prove they were coppers to us, but they didn't. It was like they had to beat us to our knees and keep us there before they did anything like that. So we didn't stop fighting back. Why should we? We were defending ourselves. The situation started to get real when one of them actually tried to strangle me. He was grabbing me around my throat and had said, yes, let's see how fucking clever you are now. I felt my eyes were on the verge of popping out of my head and I could hardly breathe. That is when I saw her. From the corner of my eye, I could see this white woman coming up the escalator, a witness. She didn't know there were coppers either. She couldn't have known. She came rushing over to help us. She saw that my eyes were popping out of my head and my tongue was hanging out as if I was being choked to death. And I was. Right there and then, the only difference between me and George Floyd was there weren't any mobile phones around to record him strangling me. If that white woman had not been there, if she hadn't have punched him in the back to get him to release me, I would have been as dead as George Floyd. It was only when we were on our knees, lying on the ground, did they finally feel like showing us their IDs, and we were all under arrest for mugging. We all fit the description of a gang of youths committing a series of muggings in the area. It was crap, of course, but that's the way it was back then. Sure enough, a police van arrived. Uniform officers this time. I was handcuffed to one of them. Then I couldn't believe it. They brought in the same white woman who was trying to help us. They threw her onto the floor of the van like she was rubbish. Then this officer came into the van and was slapping the white woman in her face because she came in and intervened on our side. That is all she did. As a mother, she couldn't stand for it. All she saw was white men attacking boys. The last thing I remember about being in that was one of the coppers whispering in my ear, "Just you wait till we get you to the fucking station. Just you bloody wait."
So that's episode 2. In episode 3, confrontation between the black youth and the police leave the streets and head into the heart of the British justice system. And with black power now on the rise, people are ready for the new challenge. But it's going to be one hell of a fight, blood.
The moment we were arrested, the world changed. The world changed completely.
Winston feels the full force of the police brutality, but cases like his would only serve to energise the black power fight against authorities.
He wanted complete control of me, so he said to me, "Take your hat off. Get over there, you bastard," and grabbed my head and slammed it against the wall.
Farouk faces a new threat as racist thugs go on an attack, trying to get rid of immigrants by any means necessary.
I woke up choking. I opened the door to the staircase and the flames leapt up at me from the staircase. And then I thought, I've got to get out of here.
What song takes you to a moment in your life?
I knew that I didn't look like everyone else, but because the music was so powerful, it pushed through that.
Songs to Live By is a podcast bringing together black voices from different generations to discuss something we all love, music. We'll be finding out what songs take them back.
Hearing it made me quite emotional. I was lifted into this space of connection.
And motivate them forward.
Absolutely shaped what I wanted to do with my life.
Songs to Live By. Listen on BBC Sounds.